This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. And we'll start today in the nation's capital, where just last night the U.S. Senate passed a sweeping criminal justice reform bill. It's called the First Step Act, and it proposes some pretty significant changes to the federal prison system. In what's become a rare show of bipartisanship, the Senate passed the bill 87-12, with just 12 Republicans voting no. Joining us now to break down what's in the bill and how it will affect the criminal justice system both nationally and here in Massachusetts is retired federal judge, Harvard Law School senior lecturer, and WBUR's legal analyst, Nancy Gertner. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be on again.
So I should start here by saying that we're reaching you at a meeting of the Sentencing Project, which advocates for reform in sentencing. The project worked on the First Step Act, and you're on the board of the Sentencing Project. So let's start with this bill itself. Break it down for us. What does it do? What's in it?
Well, in 2010, the disparity between sentencing for crack and the sentencing for cocaine was changed. It was 100 times more punitive for crack than for powder cocaine, and that was changed in 2010, but only going forward, not retroactive, which is a very troubling kind of thing. This particular bill, the First Step Act, makes that disparity going retroactive. So it means you don't have a guy in prison who was sentenced under one law, which we now found to have been unjust, while the guy next to him would have been under another. So that is retroactive, and that's a good thing. In addition, they've changed. There is a federal three strikes law for drug offenses, which had been a mandatory life. It's now 25 years, but that's not retroactive. So that's, again, only going forward, which means, again, you could have two people in the same cell who were sentenced under different regimes. There was a concept in the federal sentencing about stacking offenses. If you had three sales of marijuana, for example, that you were doing in the same month, let's say, on different dates, the judge who was sentencing you for all three could stack one on the other and lead to a very punitive sentence. One guy in particular famously who had both modest sales of marijuana and had a gun, got life without parole as a result of stacking. The new bill prohibits stacking unless there is a prior drug conviction. So the only one who would be in that situation would be someone who had a prior conviction. And then with respect to the mandatory minimums, it provided a way of a judge making a distinction for a broader category of offenders to get out from a mandatory minimum. These are wonderful changes. Let me pause and make sure I say that. But the name of the bill is reflective of what it did, which is a first step.
So
it's not major sentencing reform. This is a first step.
Yeah, we'll get to that in just a second. Those were all sentencing reforms that you mentioned. I know that the bill also addresses U.S. prisons on some fronts as well. It makes it against the law to use restraints on pregnant inmates. It requires prisoners to be incarcerated no more than 500 miles from their home. And it also focuses on increasing access to rehabilitation and training programs to help prisoners prepare for reentry and also potentially reduce their sentences, right?
Yes, there's no question. There's an increase in good time credits, which could lead to some people getting out of jail earlier than they otherwise might not. The provision requiring being closer to home is terribly important, since most of the men I sentenced wound up being sent to the middle of the country, which meant their families couldn't visit, et cetera.
Wow.
So those are very good things. The issue with respect to prison programs, $75 million, as I understand, was appropriated to prison programming, what was rather authorized. It needs to be appropriated. That's a terribly important distinction. That is to say, you can say it's wonderful to have prison programs, but unless you actually get them the money, they will have accomplished nothing. I just heard at my meeting that, for example, 16,000 people are waiting, are on the waiting list for literacy programs in the Bureau of Prisons, 6,000 to get a GED. So even with respect to very ordinary programs like, you know, literacy and GEDs, the Bureau of Prisons is not close to meeting the need. And
yeah.
The question will be, will this money be enough to meaningfully affect changes in the prison program? And will, in fact, the money be appropriated?
So speaking of meaningful change, I know this bill was actually introduced in the House earlier this year. At that time, Hillary Shelton, the Washington Bureau director of the NAACP, was worried that it could result in some people staying in prison longer and that, quote, it may exacerbate the racial and ethnic disparities of those who are incarcerated. Do you feel like those concerns have been addressed?
Well, the House bill was dealing with prison programming for the most part and not prison sentences. So this is different, and this is a good thing because it's dealing with prison sentences. And the crack cocaine retroactivity goes a long way to affecting the racial disparities that she was talking about, making that retroactive since crack was principally distributed in communities of color, powder in, principally in white communities. So I think it goes a long way to addressing that. There are pretty endemic racial disparities in the criminal justice system, which this doesn't address, but that's another matter entirely.
I think it's worth noting here the current political climate. We're talking about a president who is very much a law and order president, has been very hard on crime in some of his rhetoric. What do you make of the fact that the Congress was able to reach this kind of bipartisan agreement under the political moment?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, apart from President Trump, since 2008, there's been a growing movement on the right, particularly after the 2008 recession, that long sentences for prisoners was not cost-effective. And the Koch brothers, in particular, funded some rather interesting initiatives in states around the country. So there's been there was a group called Right on Crime, of which Newt Gingrich was a prominent member. So I think that Trump was late to jump on this bandwagon, as were some of the other members of the Senate. But it was a bandwagon on the right. It had always been, an initiative of the left. So I'm not surprised that people have come together. Maybe that it came together this fast and that, Mitch McConnell, who has never been a supporter, jumped on board. That's surprising.
You mentioned at the top that's called the First Step Act, and you see it as that. There was some kind of political split in the Democratic Party. I know Senator Kamala Harris said that she was trying to weigh letting the perfect become the enemy of the good. There were lots of folks who said this didn't go far enough. Ultimately, the feeling that something is better than nothing, I think, prevailed amongst those on the left. Do you feel like this is a first step? Are we going to see more criminal justice reform in the future?
Well, I think that we certainly have to press for that, because my understanding from the statistics I just heard literally moments ago is that the crack cocaine retroactivity, for example, affects 2,600 people in prison, which is not a very large number. So this is not a dramatic move reducing mass incarceration. It's not addressing that at all. And, I keep on saying this over and over again to my students, less incarceration is no more of a criminal justice policy than more incarceration. Criminal justice policy has to be about dealing with programs in prison, dealing with diversion, dealing with reentry, dealing with how you address the extraordinary needs of prisoners who have come out of prison, the extraordinary needs of people who wind up in the criminal justice system. That's a criminal justice policy, not just, I'll lower the amount, X amount. That's a good thing to lower sentences, but it can't stand alone. So, I understand the criticisms, but this, I have to admit that when you step back, 10 years ago, we never believed, those of us who were active in this area, never believed that it was possible for sentences to decline. So I'm enormously impressed by that fact.
Most folks will remember back in April, Governor Baker signed a landmark criminal justice reform bill here in Massachusetts. It was pretty wide ranging, raised the minimum age for juvenile offenders, encouraged use of more diversion programs, eliminated mandatory minimums for certain low level drug offenses. How does this national bill, assuming that it passes and becomes law, how will it affect Massachusetts in light of our own criminal justice reform?
The national bill only affects federal sentencing. It doesn't affect state sentencing, and most of the criminal justice, most people in prison are in state prisons. And the Massachusetts bill, while it was important in dealing with juvenile justice and bail reform and diversion, didn't really reduce sentences dramatically. The sentences that were reduced were for the lowest level drug offenses, including marijuana, low-level dealer sort of users. It actually increased penalties for fentanyl and other offenses. I regard that as an even more modest bill than the federal one, because it's not dealing with length of sentences for the most part at all. Massachusetts, what happens in Massachusetts is that the rate of incarceration is not particularly high. We're good in that respect. The racial disparities are rather dramatic. And the bill that was passed doesn't really address those disparities.
Okay. Before you go, I just want to ask you while we have you about one other legal matter, and that is the sentencing of Michael Flynn. Yesterday, a federal judge, U.S. District Court Judge Emmett Sullivan, delayed sentencing for the former national security advisor. He pleaded guilty last year to lying to the FBI about his conversations with the Russian ambassador. At one point during the proceedings yesterday, the judge said, quote, "I'm not hiding my disgust, my disdain for your criminal offense." What do you make of the judge's behavior yesterday, and was it an appropriate way to handle it?
That is an incredibly complicated question to ask a former judge, but let me try. Putting aside what he said and to what he did, which is putting off the sentencing and suggesting that unless Flynn cooperated more, he was going to consider time. That's a little bit troubling because the prosecutor came into court and said this guy has done big time cooperation, has been doing it, you know, for over a year, and we are satisfied. And here's a judge sort of second guessing the nature of the cooperation, which you don't usually do. I mean, frankly, you usually defer to the prosecutor when the prosecutor says this was substantial cooperation. In addition, what I worry about is that the comments he made are going to basically could wind up with challenges to his continuation in the case. In other words, a defendant could well believe that he's now biased against the defendant going forward. And, you know, that's not something that doesn't make sense to have invited.
Well, there's a lot left to play out on that for sure.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I agree with what he said. I'm not sure that I would have said it.
Fair enough. That's retired federal judge, now a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst, Nancy Gertner. Judge Gertner, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, the year's biggest stories in women's sports. I'm Chris Siderick, and this is Radio Boston.